Thank you, Clint, and I'm delighted to have the opportunity to talk to you all here today. I'm going to talk about Australia's strategic environment. I'm going to talk about the past, but I'm primarily going to focus on the future. What lies in store for Australia? What do we need to do in the defence strategic space to prepare for contingencies down the line? We know that the primary purpose of the ADF is to protect or defeat an armed attack on Australia and its interests. Since the 1940s, successive governments have endorsed strategic guidance that's the product of integrated assessments of Australia's strategic environment. While other factors such as service lobbying for tanks, ships and aircraft influence force structure decisions, it's strategic guidance that fundamentally shapes choices about capability investments for the nation's defence. Deciding on the capabilities to achieve the defence mission is not as straightforward as it might appear. As Hugh White observes, capability doesn't just mean equipment. It encompasses everything required to conduct military operations. Equipment, trained personnel, munitions, bases and support facilities, servicing and repair capacities, spare parts and fuel supplies, command and control communication systems, and the document procedures necessary to knit them together. But before any of these investment choices are made, governments rely on detailed analysis from key agencies regarding the current and most importantly, the future strategic environment for Australia. This is typically provided in classified form, but distilled into assessments that form the basis of strategic guidance released to the public in defence white papers and other high-level documents such as periodic strategic reviews. Now, my intention today isn't to talk about capability investments. Instead, I want to focus my thoughts mainly on what comes before these choices are made. That is, assessing the nature of Australia's strategic environment, both now and into the future. Michael Cook, who was the Director General of the Office of National Assessments, now called the Office for National Intelligence, for much of the 1980s, is said to have cautioned his analysts about the need to look beneath surface trends to the deeper drivers of change in the international system. Cook did this by invoking the geological metaphor of calm surface waters underpinned by tectonic ocean shifts. When it comes to the international strategic environment, what we see on the surface isn't necessarily a reliable indicator of what's going on underneath. Choppy waters don't necessarily portend transformative change, and calm waters don't always foreshadow stability. In strategic analysis, what we see isn't always what there is. Now, from my perspective, this needs to be tempered by two further caveats. The first is that many strategic thinkers in each generation tend to believe they're inhabiting a unique period of change. But the reality is, most of history tends to be linear, with major discontinuities and genuine shocks few and far between. How often do we hear that the global system is experiencing transformative change? How often does this actually happen? I would argue very rarely, in fact. If we're to think of genuinely transformative events, and here I'm talking about international relations since World War II, those that genuinely reorder the international system, I can think of only two: the end of the Cold War and 9/11. And 9/11 is a bit of a stretch. Secondly, strategic thinkers have a terrible record of prediction, both in terms of failed predictions and a failure to predict what transpires. No one seriously predicted the end of the Cold War and the collapse of the USSR. Those in the 1990s who optimistically predicted that globalisation and interdependence would see off the Hobbesian mindset of interstate rivalries got it spectacularly wrong. Predictions of the collapse of North Korea and even the Chinese Communist Party are a distant memory. And who foreshadowed Brexit or the disruption of Donald Trump? Scanning the current global strategic picture, a number of trends are apparent. Materially weaker states and non-state actors are leveraging the mix of new and old technologies to level the playing field economically and technologically advanced states. For instance, threats from North Korea and Russia to escalate to nuclear use early in any conflict reflect an understanding that they would be defeated in a straight conventional fight against the US and its allies. In the realm of cyber, China, North Korea and Russia aim to exploit vulnerabilities in operating systems as a deterrent signal, as well as a means of confirming their strategic reach against the West. The rules-based international order is under increasing challenge from major powers who seek to circumvent prevailing international law, established treaties and agreements, and other global governance arrangements. This, of course, includes China, but it's one of the profound ironies of our time that the US under the Trump administration also falls into this camp. Strategic rivalry between the US and China has quickly morphed into an adversarial relationship. Zero-sum way in which Beijing and Washington regard their interactions is sharpened under the Trump administration, but it would be wrong to assume Trump is the cause. Anyone who talks to government agencies or think tanks in D.C. these days appreciates that there is a strong bipartisan consensus on China. Indeed, adversarial perceptions of China really took hold under the Obama administration. And the Chinese leadership has been very clear in its challenge to the U.S. and its view time has come from a more muscular assertion of China's great power status in Asia and indeed beyond. The link between economic and security interests is increasingly explicit. Many US allies, including Australia, are enmeshed in China's economy through intimate trading and investment relations. But these same countries craft defense policies with an underlying assumption that supporting US forces in war against China remains a very plausible option. Relatedly, the US is making many key decisions on security issues through the prism of what the White House regards as economic value. Security alliances, including the negotiation of status of forces agreements, are subject to accounting slide rules that measure the financial cost to the US rather than how these alliances enable US global leadership. Now, looking more specifically at our region, we know that China's transition to strategic preeminence is well underway. Beijing's capacity to directly influence strategic outcomes has increased exponentially, while its willingness to book opposition has already disappeared. China has an established preference for a tributary-based system based on hierarchy in Asia, where it is top dog. But regional countries remain wary of Beijing's reach and intentions. The high-level political credibility of US security assurances to allies is increasingly in doubt. Military-to-military and intelligence cooperation in US alliances remains strong, but serious doubts have emerged about the long-term commitment of Washington to defend its allies in Asia. President Trump's capricious approach to alliances, coupled with high-pitched America First rhetoric, has stoked anxieties about the credibility of US extended deterrence. And North Korea's nuclear weapons strike force poses significant challenges to regional security, not just because of Pyongyang's taste for coercion, but also because of the potential proliferation pressures it promotes. Can we seriously say that Japan will not look at the nuclear option over the next 5 to 10 years? Now, it goes without saying, but I'll say it anyway, that Australia has a lot of stake in all of this. Consider the following. Australia's continued economic growth is highly contingent on assuring access to key trade routes and investment destinations. More than half our exports are bound to Northeast Asia alone. Free trade and a rules-based international order aren't just policy preferences for Canberra, they are prerequisites for national prosperity going forward. While Australia's security alliance with the US is the single most important plank in our strategic policy, our relationship with Beijing is far more nuanced than the US-China relationship, simply because of our size, trade flows, and our location in Asia. Australian ministers may be pro-alliance, but they're also highly ambivalent about being wedged in supporting strategic confrontation in China, against China, I should say. Despite talking a big game, Australia remains a free rider in alliance terms. We are no better, and in many respects worse, in contributing materially to the US than NATO, Japan, or South Korea. Australia remains acutely vulnerable to being pleased by the US to contribute more to the alliance, both in terms of underwriting the US presence in our part of the world for greater financial contributions and in taking greater risks, such as joint maritime or air patrols in the US and South China Sea and other theatres in the Indo-Pacific. With the exception of 1942 after the fall of Singapore, Australia has never truly been exposed to the cold winds of direct security threats. Since the 1950s, Great Power Alliance, supplemented by extended nuclear deterrence, has served to assure successive governments that we have a safety net if things do really nasty in our region. The US military's force projection capability, in particular the US Navy's ability to sail unchallenged through the Indo-Pacific, has provided confidence that freedom of navigation across Australia's key trading routes is assured. These things can no longer be taken for granted. While there have been moments of apprehension among policymakers about the long-term future of the US strategic commitment to our region, think of the 1969 Nixon Doctrine and the early Clinton years after the end of the Cold War, what we are witnessing today is unprecedented. An apparent US retreat from global leadership. Now, like moderate aircraft turbulence, this may pass if Donald Trump is defeated in next year's presidential election. But should he win a second term that takes his administration through to 2025, not only can we expect more of the same, but many of the America First norms about alliances and global leadership will become baked into long-term US policies. This is highly unwelcome news for Australian policymakers. In an increasingly fluid neighbourhood, the prospect of US pullback over the next decade has transformative implications for the way we think about defence capability investment. As I see it, there are at least three implications. The first is that Australian governments must accept the premise that capability investment decisions should be decoupled from an assumption the US will be there for us if our security is directly threatened. This requires a shifting mindset among Australian political leaders and large sections of the bureaucracy. It's important to remember that there has always been a healthy scepticism in the Australian strategic community about the likelihood of US support should Australia's core security interests be threatened by an external power. That said, the highly contingent nature of US support was perhaps better understood by Australian policymakers in decades past than at present. In frank terms, the 1976 Strategic Basis Paper, essentially a cabinet-endorsed review of Australia's security environment, which was endorsed by the Fraser government, noted that, quote, the extent to which the US accepts a commitment to defend Australia will always depend upon US judgments regarding its own interests at the time. Much will depend on the circumstances of the day, end quote. The second implication is that Australian governments must be more focused on capability investments that are designed to defend core national interests, including national territory, against coercion or attack. There have been recent calls for Australia to consider achieving a threshold nuclear weapons capability, that is, acquiring the technological breakthrough capacity to sprint to acquiring a nuclear force should our strategic circumstances rapidly deteriorate. While we can never say never, I'm not in favour of this capability investment because it's a signal it would send to our regional neighbours, particularly Indonesia, and the manifold breaches of arms control and non-proliferation commitments that would result. I am, however, very much in favour of Australia seriously exploring its own land-based missile defence and ground-to-air missile capabilities, coupled with a greater focus on long-range strike assets that raise the costs for major powers, including China, who would either threaten or attack Australia's interests. The third implication is that Canberra needs to work on weaning Australia off dependence on the US, inclusive capabilities such as equipment, munitions, servicing, repair capacities, and spares. Now, this is easier said than done, given the deep integration of Australia's defence capabilities into the US network. Just think of the $17 billion investment in the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter. Is it even plausible to disconnect this capability from a dependence on continued US technical support in the long term? And Australia has highly privileged access to US strategic and defence intelligence connection under existing diffuser and bilateral sharing arrangements. Would we want to put this at risk by reducing dependence in another realm of defence capabilities? This is a really tough question to answer. But in my you if we're serious about genuinely sovereign defence capability investments in the long term, becoming what we might call a strategically independent middle power, tough questions like these need at least to be addressed. What I've outlined here will, of course, require a major uptick in defence expenditure and a more disciplined approach to decisions about the type of kit we invest in. This really requires governments taking full control of the capability investment process, including moving beyond narrow service preferences and a presumption against off-the-shelf capabilities. As we look to the third decade of the 20th century, Australia's defence effort needs to be focused more squarely on ensuring procurement decisions and acquisition policy are closely aligned to strategic guidance. As I've argued, Australia's strategic environment is evolving rapidly. Our neighbourhood is getting rougher, our friends are becoming less reliable, and our capacity to defend our core interests independent of our ally is dubious. This isn't just about winning a fight, if it comes to that. It's also about deterring potential adversaries, including major powers, by raising the costs to outweigh any potential benefits they might think could be gained by coercing or attacking Australia. It's time for Australian governments to reaffirm genuine commitment to self-reliance with all of the costs and associated risks that that entails. This requires serious money for sure, but it also requires the power of imagination and innovation. If Australia doesn't try to forge its own strategic destiny, then others will surely do it for us.